When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to IFHPodcastNetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 88. Writing is easy. All you have to do is cross out all the wrong words. Mark Twain.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. Now, today on the show, we have screenwriter and studio executive Jeff Willis. Jeff has been in the business now for over 15 years and has worked on some major movies like Avengers Endgame, Captain Marvel, Black Panther, Thor Ragnarok, among other films. He is also a consultant on the business of screenwriting. And what I found really interesting about our conversation is about 30 to 35 minutes into our talk, we start to really discuss the entrepreneurial screenwriter. This is a screenwriter that is using their stories, their unproduced screenplays, to generate revenue for themselves outside of Hollywood, outside of the traditional way a screenwriter would make money. And it was a very, very powerful conversation. And I hope it gives you guys some ideas about how you can make money with your stories, with your screenplays, that is not strictly dependent on your film getting produced. I know it sounds crazy, but just take a listen. Enjoy my conversation with Jeff Willis. I'd like to welcome to the show Jeff Willis. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
I am doing as well as I can be in this crazy upside-down world we live in today.
I know. I keep telling everyone, you know, pandemic-adjusted terms is my go-to phrasing these days.
Pandemic-adjusted terms. I mean, we live now currently when we're recording this episode, I mean, we're literally in Blade Runner. Because of the fires. I mean, some of the images coming out of San Francisco literally look like Blade Runner 2049. It's insane. And now every day I walk out of my house, I live in LA, I walk out and I go, can't go outside today. Nope, too much smoke in the air. Got to go back in the house. It's an insane place. It's like the whole world is crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, who knew that Roger Deakins was going to DP the apocalypse?
I mean, you're right. That's actually real. I'm going to steal that one. I like that one because I don't know. It's insane. And our business has changed so radically, and so many things have changed, not only for writers, but for the business in general. I mean, if I would have told you, hey, Jeff, you know, in January, you know, no blockbuster season this year for the first time since 1977. There will not be a summer blockbuster season. And, we're going to shut down the world for at least a couple months. And you would have looked, at me like, that's a horrible pitch, and we're not making that movie.
Yeah, exactly. Too unrealistic.
It's too on the nose. No one would believe something as crazy as that.
No one would believe something would happen.
So how did you get into the business in the first place, sir?
So I, I started in film school. I didn't really get interested in film until I was in high school. And it was one of those things where a friend of mine who was a, you know, one of those like kids, like I wanted to be a director since I was 9. My parents got me a camcorder when I was 10, kind of people. He always knew he wanted to make movies. And it was one of those projects in high school where, they give you the option. They're like, oh, you can do an essay, or you can do a project, or you can do a test. And he was like, I want to make a movie. And I was like, well, that sounds kind of fun. I'm like, I'll help him out with that. And then the process of, being behind the scenes and making something just totally blew my mind. I had so much fun doing it. And then once I knew he was going to go to film school, I'm like, oh, that's a thing. You can go to school for this. Like, that sounds awesome. So, I went to, Long Beach State for film school. And then my senior year in film school, I interned in the business, to get my foot in the door and get some college credits and everything. And, that was, almost, 20 years ago, so 15, 20 years ago. So over the last, over the last 15 years, I've been just, working my way up and, climbing the ladder and then writing on the side.
And, the business has changed a slight bit since you got into it originally, would you say?
little tiny bit, there are, things like emails, which are way more important than they used to be. We don't really send interns to the copy room to copy, 400 scripts manually anymore.
God, I remember those days. Jeez. I was an office intern for a show for Fox when I was in college, and that was – I had to make copies. It sucked.
Yeah. No, no one wanted to intern on Fridays because that was the day you had to photocopy every script for every executive to take home with them. It's just,
and then don't forget the color, the different drafts and the different color pages that you got to stick in. And oh,
exactly. No, it's good times.
good times. But that's also a thing that a lot of writers and people getting into the business don't understand, that you do got to pay your dues in one way, shape, or form. And I think from when we were coming up, it was a little bit more accepted. And I think there was a little bit more access even because the competition wasn't nearly as brutal as it is today. It was simpler times, as I'm sure when we were doing it growing up. It seemed like there was just, oh my God, how are you going to break in? But looking back, you're like, oh my God, it was wide open. Like there was nothing. Like I got internships and this, and I got into that, and there was so many more opportunity. But now it's a little bit more complicated. But I think it's a lot more. There was a lot more opening to the whole mentorship program and kind of like getting in and learning that way, and then doing that crap work, PA work, intern work, things like that, to kind of get to the next level and learn.
Yeah, it's funny how often I tell people that too, because, and you talked, your other episodes or your podcast about how important networking is, and it's like, that's the gong you keep banging, because it is, I don't think a single job that I've ever gotten since my first job has come at anywhere other than networking. Someone knew someone or put in a call for me or told me they knew of something. And as much as the industry has changed in terms of, how it does business or the things it focuses on or the types of projects it does, like the one thing that never changes is, by and large, with few exceptions, the majority of people make their way in this industry by starting at the very bottom, working real hard for a real long time until eventually it pays off. And, that has become more difficult in some ways, but, also in other ways, like it hasn't really changed. That's what everyone does is they have to spend a long time paying their dues to get to the point they want to be.
Now, can you, cause I'm sure you work in Hollywood, you work with some big studios. I'm assuming that you get hit up all the time, especially when someone knows that you work at Marvel or you work at this company or that company. They're just like, Hey, can you read my script? Hey, I got this great Ant-Man, script for Ant-Man 4. Can you, or they try to like, suck, like, what can you do for me, Jeff? Kind of energy, which is the biggest mistake anyone could ever make when trying to network with someone, because You just want to get away. It's just like being that wanting guy who wants a date at a club. Girls can feel it, and vice versa. The same thing happens in the, and I still call it desperation jacar. So you would actually, it's a cologne that you're drenched in with, and you can smell it. You can sense this desperation. I always tell people that the only way to really truly network is, one, to try to be as authentic as possible, and two, to be of value. What can I do for you? How can I help you? And that's how you build a relationship, not what can you do for me? Would you agree?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's funny because I give that exact advice to pretty much everyone that asks. And it's funny, I'm pretty active on, you know, Twitter, Reddit, a couple other, you know, things. And it is funny how often people ask that question. How do I network? How do I make connections? And it's funny because, as soon as you start with, well, over the course of several years, you have to, and people go, no, I'm out. Like, no, tell me the other person. I can do it in 2 weeks. But it's, you know, that's the, what you said is exactly right. I mean, it is about providing mutual value. And you can't be the person that walks in and says, you know, what can you do for me? Nice to meet you, you know, like read my script. And what's funny is how often people will literally just assume that that means, you know, like bumping at one interaction. So it's like, okay, I won't ask them to read my script the first time. I'll say, nice to meet you at the pitch event. And then I'll go home and then I'll email them and say, will you read my script? You know, and I keep telling people that's not what it's about. It is, again, about, you know, providing a mutual benefit and showing that you're genuinely interested in someone else, because we all have people that, you know, want something from us. We all have people that are looking to leverage what we can do for them for their own benefit. And we're all in that position where we all need benefit from someone else. But you can't make a habit of being the person that is constantly treating it like a one-way street and saying, what can you do for me? How can you help me? Help me, help me, help me, without offering something in return. And it's funny because the next question that a lot of young writers, you know, often ask is like, well, what could I possibly offer, you know, an executive, you know, or what can I offer someone, you know, in a position of power that I need something from? And it's funny because I tell people, well, I mean, think about, you have to anticipate, you know, what they need, what they're looking for, that kind of thing. They are meeting with writers because they need good quality writers that can, you know, pitch to them, that can help them fill out, you know, a slate of, you know, of talent that they're looking at. You know, they need people who can, they can rely on, that they know that, you know, when their boss says, here's a concept I'm interested in, they can bring someone in and vet really quickly whether or not they're a good fit so that they can look good to their boss. So your value as a writer, you know, isn't in, you know, here's a script, buy it from me. It's, I can, you know, I can tell stories. I can develop characters. I can take what you're giving me and synthesize that and give you back something that you can, you know, show to your boss, show to your department head, show to a producer or a director, and make you look good. And that's how you get into these relationships where, and, you know, the more I'm, the higher the levels I get to in this industry, the more I see it's true, where, you know, there are very few people in this industry that have the power to, you know, to green light or even to spend money, you know, nowadays.
Yeah, very few.
There are just so few of those positions around. Yeah. And those people tend to have people that they like and go to over and over again, because those people have demonstrated, you know, an ability to give them what they're looking for. So they say, great, I need a rewrite on this. You know, this spec is pretty good, but the dialogue sucks. You know, I know a guy who's my dialogue guy, and I can bring him in and he'll polish this up for me. And you don't get to be in a position like that without offering some value to someone else. The guy that keeps saying, will you read my spec? Will you do something for me? Never becomes the guy that gets a call from a studio head saying, look, I need a last minute dialogue polish on this. I'll give you $100,000 for a week's worth of work, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very true. That's a lot of times people will ask, like, hey, why does that director keep getting work? He stinks. Like, his movies are bad, but he keeps getting work, or that writer keeps getting work. Why? Because exactly what you said, they have proven that they can provide a service and get it finished, and actually get them a final product. Good, bad, or indifferent, they got something at the end of it. And that you can show that you've completed as a director of 3, 4, 5 films. Like, okay, at least we know he or she's going to get it over the finish line. Same thing goes for writers. Like, we're going to get a draft out of this guy, or we're going to get a polish out of this person. And that is more valuable a lot of times than the most talented writer that no one's ever heard of. Is that, because they're unproven and Hollywood is fairly skittish when it comes to new stuff like that, taking risks.
Yeah, no, the number of times that I've told people that too, where it's like, and again, I think this is a saying that pretty much everyone says, but you know, it's better to be, you know, someone who is pretty good at their job and easy to get along with than someone who's a genius and not, because it is true. Like what most executives are looking for in a situation, especially when you're developing something, like development is a process of incrementally getting closer and closer to something that you can feel comfortable shooting. Right. Like, it is rare that you either A, buy a script and you're like, I'm going to shoot this as is, no notes, or where you say, you know, I'm going to buy this script and it's only going to take one rewrite and we're going to get all the way there. You know, it's most often an evolutionary process. So rather than being the writer who is difficult to get along with and occasionally brilliant and hoping that you really just hit that grand slam, you know, every time you're up to bat, it's so much better to be the writer that's like, look, I may not write the most genius stuff in the world, but if you give me a set of notes, I can get you most of the way to what you're trying to do. You know, I can get you 80% of the way there every time I do a draft. And again, that's what becomes valuable, because then the development exec can go back to his people, his producers, his studio heads, and say, look, we paid this money for this work, and look how much better it is further along. It's almost, you know, like, where do we go from here? It gives them that constant evolution that they're looking for in getting the project more and more ready for production. And, you know, I've always told people, you know, if you ask me whether I'd rather be, you know, a spec writer making, you know, $1 million spec sales, or, you know, like this journeyman writer who's getting, you know, 50, 60 grand, 100 grand a draft, but regularly doing rewrites and stuff, I would be that second writer every time. Because, you know, that is where you not only do the work and you keep working in this business as a writer, but it's also where you make the most connections and the most value in your career, is like the number of people who are like, that guy can get me 80% of what I need. If I hire him and to do a pass, he'll get me what I need in that script.
80% is huge. Like, that is if you can get a script to 80% to where you want it to be, that is, because most people can't get it to 10%.
Yeah, no, it's funny. My very first executive job, I'm looking at, and it's funny because this actually parlayed into a writing assignment for me, but you know, it was one of those things. And one of the areas that, you know, I think is so important for writers is understanding writing for budget and understanding, you know, what things cost, because there are so few people that can do that. But it is like the number one consideration when people are rewriting stuff is trying to hit budget numbers and production, you know, logistics that they have to work within. But this guy writes a script, and I can't remember the details, but it was, you know, the third act is this huge, you know, house mansion explodes, you know, like explosions, helicopters, you know, everything. And at the time we were an independent company. So we were like, look, like everything, script is great. The third act gets, you know, quote unquote, a little out of control. And we need to write it cheaper. We need a cheaper version of a third act that, you know, that doesn't miss any of the, you know, the character, the important character moments or the arcs, but it's just literally cheaper to shoot. So the guy goes back and comes back and turns in his rewrite. And now the third act is like, I forget. It's like takes place at like a ski chalet. There's snow. There's more explosions. There's, you know, gunfire. And everyone's looking at the script going, this is more expensive than the last version, you know? And the writer just didn't understand what elements made a cheaper shoot. And it's one of those things where, like, that's what I think is so important with, you know, with writers who are trying to have a career at this, is you need to understand. And it's one of the reasons why I'm so glad you do this podcast and there are other business resources out there, because it's not just about writing good characters or compelling narrative. It's also about understanding, like, the business that drives the art. So, like, if you don't understand how to make those business considerations, like, work, you're not going to be hired very often, because that's what they need, is they need someone to say, I need this script rewritten to be shot $5 million cheaper, but don't lose any of the good stuff. You just need to figure out a better way to do it.
Right. Exactly. So instead of a cast of thousands, that is going to cost you, you know, a lot of money to shoot that big giant action sequence, maybe you could do it in a different way that they can drop that budget just a bit, so everyone's happier.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of one of those things, like, so it's $20 million to shoot it this way. is there any way to rewrite it so that we could shoot it for, say, the $8 million we actually have? Because if we can't, then we're going with something else, because I don't have an extra $12 million to give you.
Exactly. And I think for writers specifically, you know, when you write, I've heard this so many times from writers, like, should I, you know, box myself into budget, or should I just let my imagination flow? And I always tell people, like, well, what's the end game here? Because if it's a spec script to show what you can do, then as a writer, then let your mind flow. Understand that the chances of that getting produced is going to be nil to none, but you also don't want to box yourself in completely. It all depends on your end game. If you're trying to produce a movie for, you know, $100,000 and make an independent film, you can't have that giant action sequence in it. That's just not the way it works. So you kind of have to work things out a little bit. Would you agree?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it also, I think, has to do a lot with, you know, with the notes or the reason you're coming in, you know, to meet. And it's one of the questions that I don't hear asked often enough by writers. But, like, you know, you come in and there's a set of notes and they tell you what they want to accomplish in the script.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And now, back to the show.
But very few writers, you know, will take the time to ask, like, what is your goal with this, with these notes? Are right. you just trying to tweak, are you just trying to tweak the story? Are you legitimately trying to make it cheaper to shoot? Or do you care about budget? Like, are you willing to blow it up? Like, in the conversation that, you know, that is had about a rewrite, so often it's only looked at in terms of story and character. And, you know, it's really important, I think, to have that conversation, because a lot of times, sometimes even executives don't know. And more importantly for the writer, it also tells you which notes are really important and which ones aren't. Because, like, you can kind of go through, if you're having a legitimate conversation about the business considerations of, you know, the notes, and there isn't one for some of the notes, then you know that that note is, like, a personal preference, or it's something, you know, it's something more subjective. Versus, you know, I can't have this shot on a cruise ship because that location's too expensive or whatever. So the more you can have an open conversation with whoever's hiring you about the kinds of notes they're doing, what the motivation is for why they want it done, it doesn't just, you know, help you as a writer, but it also helps you turn in a draft that is more likely to be what they want. It's able to really hit the areas that the things that they want. And again, it makes a development executive look like a superhero. If they give you a script and you rewrite it, and for $50,000, you cut $10 million out of the budget. Like, that is like hero level stuff for a development executive to be able to say. So it's always worth considering those kinds of things when you're considering writing assignments, because that's what so much of this business is. The underlying business drives so much of this.
Now, can you kind of this? I want to hear what your thoughts are, but I think it's a myth that a lot of screenwriters and filmmakers kind of think about when they're writing their opus, their big screenplay that they're trying to create. And which is, there's nothing wrong with having ambition when you're writing a screenplay, but there has to be truth, raw truth involved with this. And one of them is, I've seen this happen so many times, that they're going to write the $150 million epic based on an original idea, and they've never sold anything, and the director that they might have attached to it has never directed anything close to this budget range. And they will spend 5 to 8 years peddling it around town with a sizzle reel, with thousands of dollars worth of concept art, and it's going to be the next big Marvel thing. It's going to be something just like Marvel, and they're pitching it to the studios, and they just wonder, why am I not getting any traction? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, I was just talking with a friend about this the other day, but you know, when you are creating projects, you know, the two angles that I typically advise people to go on is either, if you want to make something yourself, make it as low budget as you possibly can, because the idea is, you know, there are an ever decreasing number of people that can finance a movie depending as the budget escalates, right? So if it's $1 million, maybe there's 5,000 individuals, companies, whatever, that can make $1 million budget. You know, if it's a $5 million budget, maybe there's 2,000. If it's a $10 million budget, maybe there's 1,000. If there's a $20 million, like, you get into, like, so the more expensive you write something, the fewer and fewer places that can actually make it. And until you literally hit a point of no return, which is you are only at a level where a studio can make it. But if you look at what the studios are making, they're not doing original stuff much anymore. I mean, you know, Disney, by and large, Marvel makes stuff based on their own IP. Star Wars makes stuff based on their own IP. Disney now makes most live actions are remakes of their animated movies. Like, the number of original projects being developed at Disney is much smaller than it used to be.
And also the budgets of those, like Ivan the Great, whatever that, the monkey movie with Heisenberg that just got released on Disney Plus. Those are they make like Mulan. And the redone of all their old animated IP, or they'll make something that's probably $20 million and below. More kind of like touchy feely, really family. Sometimes sports, like the Miracle or things like that, and they still do one or two of those a year.
Yeah, exactly. But like, so what I kind of tell people is, like, look, you need to aim for the lower end of things if you want to have any hope of getting it made, because all of the development slots at the much higher level, much higher budget, are basically already reserved by people who already know what they want to make. So, you know, the business consideration I tell people is, look, you're either writing something low budget, hoping to get it made, or you're writing something super high budget because it's a sample to get hired on, you know, an assignment that already exists. But again, you know, Marvel, Disney, you know, Warner Brothers, DC, like, they all have their big budget tent poles. They don't need to take a $150 million flyer on some original superhero they created, because, you know, in the case of Marvel, there's, what, 6,800 superheroes they have to choose from already?
Jesus Christ. It's insane.
It's hard to explain sometimes, because I know that it's one of the strongest illusions in this industry. Mm-hmm. First of all, the strongest illusion is the one that screenwriters, you know, just like are off somewhere and they just, you know, write down their brilliance and, you know, type fade out and then sell it for $1 million and then disappear until they're ready to sell another one. Like, you know, that's the number one. But the second one is that you can somehow write a great script, and all of a sudden, you know, the sea will part, the doors will open, and, you know, the studios will welcome you in and pay you, you know, ungodly amounts of money to make your original project. And that just doesn't really exist anymore, because, you know, at the studio level, the studio already knows what they want to make, and they're projects that are already in development, and they need someone to execute what vision they're already trying to create. They're not looking for, you know, like, gee, we're short on, you know, franchise tentpole ideas. Like, I sure hope someone comes along and gives us one.
Yeah, that's especially Disney. That's not something that Disney is having a problem with at this point in the game.
I don't think any creative execs, you know, anywhere at any of the studios are sitting there going, gee, if only we had some ideas about what we wanted to make movies out of.
Yeah, exactly. But the whole business has become, the studio business, from when you came into the business and I came into the business, when there was that $20 million. I mean, Disney used to make 20, 30 movies a year. Mm-hmm. At 20 million, 30 million, then occasionally a few tentpoles, which now the whole business is completely driven by tentpole and spectacle. And that's just the way the business is. And if they make a movie for less than $100 million, that's insanity. Like there's rare for that to happen, because I've been saying this for years, and I actually wrote it in my book that Disney's not a movie studio anymore. They make about 15% of their revenue from exhibition of their films. They're in all the other businesses, from theme parks and t-shirts and hats and exploiting IP. That's the business that they're in. They're, you know, because the definition of a studio is a company that makes movies and makes money off of selling, you know, access to that movie. That was the traditional definition. But that's not what these studios are, especially the top, you know, three or four, like Disney, Universal, Warner Brothers. Disney does it the best, obviously. Everyone's chasing Disney.
Well, and it's funny to see how many companies are chasing Disney as well, where it's not just the studios, it's a lot of independent companies are aiming that way too, where it becomes less of a focus. Like, so when I first started working, Beacon Pictures was the company I worked for at first. And it was, I had the distinction of working at a lot of companies like after their heyday, but before they have a resurgence. So I was at, Beacon Pictures post Bring It On, Air Force One, and pre Castle, you know? So it was like, but you know, at the time, you know, Beacon was kind of the quintessential independent company, right? Which is, it had an overall deal at a studio that paid them overhead to develop stuff and, you know, and make it. And that's where so many of the, you know, so many of these movies came from, which is, you know, Disney would have first look deals with all these companies all around town, and they would bring them the stuff that they were interested in. Hey, here's a really interesting $20 million drama. Here's a, you know, and once all the work's been done, then Disney could say, it seems like you have a good business plan here. Yeah, we'll make that one. Or yeah, we'll distribute that. Or yeah, we'll give you the money to do that. And, you know, after the home video bubble burst and studios stopped kind of doing overhead deals, it was in effect independent development kind of went away. And all of these companies are now working on their own. But it's funny because now you see these independent companies trying to replicate the studio model because they know that's where the money is. So rather than seeing companies, independent production companies, you know, try to develop 40 projects hoping to make, you know, five in a year, you see them really trying to acquire established IP, that you see them trying to or develop, you know, in-house IP, but then just milk it like crazy. I mean, the number of companies I've worked with or consulted for in the last few years where the focus wasn't on development, it was getting that one project out there so that they then could concurrently develop a video game, develop a marketing campaign, work with a merchandiser to, you know, to get product out there. It really has, for better or worse, become this, you know, this, you know, horizontal, you know, effect where it's not about constantly putting out new content. It's about putting out content that, once successful enough, you can exploit in a variety of lateral ways and make multiple revenue streams. Mm-hmm. You know, in order to, in theory, get more money to make more movies. But it gets really frustrating because then you get, you know, again, instead of companies looking to make five movies a year, they may only make one because they're so focused on the other ancillary markets. And that's you know, really hard. I think it's contributed to the decline in the spec market. I think it's declined, you know, the decline in, you know, writer jobs in general. It's been really hard because there's so many other business interests now, rather than just, we need to develop new material constantly so we can make more movies constantly.
Now, would you recommend a writer, instead of writing a script, let's say they have a great idea for, you know, world building and this very epic story, whether it be in fantasy, sci-fi, action, whatever it might be, would you recommend they actually just write novels based on that story, self-distribute or self-publish those novels at first, or get it published traditionally, and they can actually start making money with their writing, in addition to now having hopefully an established IP that might make it a little bit more appetizing for that screenplay that they already wrote based on that work? So they're still making money off of their stories, and yet they also have the screenplay ready in hand. So now they can walk it. It's much more, I feel it's much more powerful for a writer to walk into an executive meeting and go, here's my best-selling book that has sold X amount of copies because I've self-published it. Here's the book series. It has a big fan base. Here's what I've built. Here's the screenplay for the first two. Is that a better pitch than, here's a screenplay?
Yeah, I mean, so it's interesting you mentioned that, because I've actually been kind of pivoting to self-publishing a lot in the last couple of years, mostly because I'm working on my own stuff in that vein. But like, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think there's two ways to look at that. And the first is, you know, the way that you're describing it is absolutely a viable path, right? Which is, if you develop something that is successful in another medium, that is obviously a feather in your cap when you go back to the screenwriting element. And the other thing that I'd say about that is that, you know, what's really important is, we all talk about how frustrating this business is, where like, you are pitching things, you don't get the job. You write stuff, it doesn't get made. Like, there is so much failure that comes, you know, often through no fault of your own, just the nature of the beast. And there's so much frustration that comes with not getting things made, waiting for approval, waiting for someone to say yes. And I really think that things like self-publishing are great, because not only is it a potential avenue where you can sell and make money on your own, but it's also that creative release. It's that you don't need permission. You right. can literally just, you know, write the end, you know, fade out, click publish, and it's available. People can buy it, and the market and your audience can speak for itself. So I often kind of recommend writers that have a lot of different ideas and a lot of different mediums consider that, because it's kind of one of those, look, if you like writing a lot of different things, maybe focus on the low budget stuff for screenwriting, and then write your huge space epics as books, you know, that you don't need to spend money to shoot and film, because it's a book, it's words on a page. So I think that it's definitely a good idea to consider other avenues to, you know, to get interest in a project and then kind of come back to it. The second part of that, though, that I would warn people against is, there's a real mentality, you know, kind of like with the networking shortcut that we talked about earlier, people want to shortcut this process. And the way that often comes in is, what a lot of writers translate what we just talked about into is, oh, if I have it as a book first, then that means it's popular and I'll have an easier time selling it.
No.
And you know, the truth is, one, not only is it like, you have to have a bona fide like bestseller. You can't sell 10,000 copies and have it really move the needle for anyone, because you know, it's one of those, let's think about this. 10,000 copies, even if all 10,000 people bought a movie ticket at $10.
And you want to make $100 million movie.
And you want to make $100 million movie, no. But you only have, you know, 100,000 in sales, you need to have legitimate like earth-shattering numbers to impress people. But the other flavor of that I see a lot is, oh, if I write it as a book first, then I'm licensing it rather than selling it to the studio, so I can reserve all these rights and everything. And I always like, again, I think I joke that, you know, my pet peeve is, you know, business stuff. You know, because it's one of those things where, and on the business side of things, when you're doing a negotiation, there's so much trade-off for what you're doing. Like, no one, unless you're J.K. Rowling, unless you're, you know, Stephanie Meyer, you don't get to dictate the terms of the agreement. So the more greedy you are with holding things back, the less likely someone is going to A, want it, or B, give you what you're asking for. So I see so many writers be like, well, if I write it as a book, then it's existing IP. So that'll get my foot in the door, because I can say it's existing IP, and then I can make a better deal for myself. And sorry, like, when you've only sold 14 copies to friends and family, like, you're not going to get a better deal at the studio than buying it outright, if that, you know?
No, I mean, when I laid out that scenario, it's a long game. That's going to take a while to build up a fan base. You've got to build basically a business around your writing. And it can work. I've seen it work. I've seen screenwriters create podcasts out of their screenplays. Mm-hmm. And turn that into you know, existing IP, where now you can monetize the podcast, but also start building an audience. There's so many ways for an ambitious entrepreneurial screenwriter to get their work out there. But it's just the one big thing that you have to worry about is work. You got to do lots of it. And it's going to take the other thing, time and patience. Like, this is not a short game. We're talking about years, not months, years, yeah, for you to build this up to the point where, if you've written 4 or 5 books over the course of 3 years, you've built up an audience around your work. Let's say there is a series. Let's say there's a podcast. Let's say there's other ancillary products that you've built around this story, which, again, everything I'm saying is completely doable in today's world and very affordable to do, to the point where an executive is panic scanning around Facebook and you pop up on their feed. They're like, what the hell is this? And all of a sudden they go to the website. They're like, what is this? They got a whole world here. They've got product lines. Now we're talking a completely different conversation where now an executive or a potential investor or somebody is now calling you because they're interested in what you're doing, as opposed to, look at me, guys, look at me, look at me. I need you. Just like, no, I'm just going to do my own thing and I'll wait for people to come to me. And from my personal experience, that's exactly what has happened to me when I started Indie Film Hustle 5 years ago, where I was drenched in desperation Jakar for a lot of my time here in LA when I first got here because I didn't know any better. And when I opened up Indie Film Hustle and Bulletproof Screenwriting, all that stuff, all of a sudden I started getting contacted by people about my projects, about things, because I've built out this thing online and I can provide value. And that's the key, value. What can you provide besides a story? Because everyone's got a story.
Right. Well, I mean, it's the word entrepreneurial is such a great phrase for this, because, you know, writers are all independent contractors. We are our own business owners. We are our own brands.
Yes.
And you have to create excitement for your work. And it's funny because some writers are only want to write, right? And some screenwriters only want to write screenplays, and that's fine. But then your version of that hustle is writing script after script after script and hoping someone notices
it. Tons.
And for people who want to do that, like, that is totally fine. Like, that's their bag. Like, that's great. But, you know, I am personally more interested in other avenues of things. So the writing things in different genres, writing things in different mediums, books, you know, whatever, trying things on my own, you know, web series, short films, you know, like any of that kind of stuff increases the chances, or at least I like to think it does, of someone seeing you in a non-standard way. Because if you only write scripts, the only way you're going to get discovered is if someone reads your script out of a stack of other scripts and says, oh my God, that's really great, let's meet this guy. But again, you never know when, you know, some executive is going to be, you know, messing around on Facebook or Twitter and someone's going to say, oh my God, have you seen this thing? This web series is hilarious. Or like, this graphic novel is my favorite thing I read this year. Have you ever heard of it? Like, that's the kind of stuff that I think that if your priority is being a creative person, you know, a creative professional, there shouldn't be any limitations on the types of projects you're willing to do or tackle, as long as they're interesting to you, because everything you put out is another chance for someone to discover you in a different way. And there's another audience to be drawn, and you can have arguments and debates over, you know, what's the best way to do that? What's the streamlined way to do it? What makes sense? What doesn't? But the truth is, like, it's such a moving target that no one ever can tell you no one has yet figured out a way to say, if you do A, B, C, and D, you'll be successful. Because if they could, we would have all done it by now.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And now, back to the show.
So, you know, the only thing that's left to do is to try A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, you know, and hope that, you know, someone somewhere sees K and is like, awesome. That's why I want to talk to that guy.
And I don't mean to interrupt you, but I think that a mind shift needs to happen with screenwriters in today's world, because and this is just my opinion, I'd love to hear what you think about it, is that if you're constantly waiting for someone else to give you permission, someone else to make your dreams come true, you are giving way too much power to the industry. You're giving way too much power to somebody you've never met to make you happy, to put food on your table, all of that stuff. I'm much more in the camp of building something myself, being able to express myself as an artist, monetize that art in a million different ways now online that you can do that and start just doing, even if you're not making a lot of money at first, just do the work, just keep working, keep pumping out content. Keep, if it's a podcast, if it's, you know, if it's a story podcast, if it's a web series, like you said, if it's books, if it's graphic novels, whatever it is, just keep pumping stuff out, because eventually, if you keep at it, you will build something of substance. You will build something that will be able to generate enough revenue so you don't have to Uber, that you don't have to do that job that you don't want. And then if something happens, great. And maybe you even want to reach out to a few people. Hey, this is what I'm doing, things like that. But you're not like, if I don't get that call, my life is over. And I feel that's the problem with filmmakers, with screenwriters, everybody in this business. You're always waiting for that permission from somebody, where in today's world, like when you and I came into the business, that wasn't an option. Like, there wasn't an option to self-publish, to do a podcast, to do web series, to actually create revenue streams from your art. It was very, very difficult. But in today's world, absolutely you can. I'd love to hear what you think.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's one of the things that, you know, the shift that I think ultimately has happened on, you know, on a larger scale is, you know, it has gone from an industry, or at least the idea of breaking in creatively, whether you're talking about publishing, write, you know, screenwriting, filmmaking, okay, whatever, has gone from a problem of access to a problem of standing out, right? And right. It's well, if you well placed. Were to ask me to choose which one I would, like, I would so much rather have the problem be figuring out how to get an audience for the content I'm able to make, rather than the problem be I need someone to give me permission to make what I want to make. So it's why I tell everyone that, you know, that wants to, that thinks about making an independent movie or whatever. Like I am so into that idea of doing it yourself, because you can. Like you said, you and I didn't have that option, you know, growing up. I mean, even when I went to film school, it was the beginning of like the digital age. So people were just starting to be able to affordably make stuff and not have to, you know, spend money on film stock and developing in a lab and stuff. So, you know, that the last few years of being able to, or the last, it's not a few years anymore, I'm old, it's the last couple of decades, the last couple of decades have seen, you know, it just consistently get cheaper and easier to shoot. You can learn to do animation at home now, you know, with After Effects, which costs you $20 a month or whatever, you know, you can learn to shoot on a GoPro camera that's $400. You know, you can learn to, like, there are so many ways that you can do stuff yourself. And again, like, I would so much rather have the problem be too much content and being seen above the mess of, like, you know, crappy projects that'll never get made because everyone thinks they can make a movie and it turns out no, they can't. You know, I would so much rather have the problem be getting visibility for your good quality stuff. One, because I think that tends to happen naturally anyway, but two, it's an easier problem to have something that exists and be like, I just need to figure out how to get people to see it, than it is to be like, I have this thing I really, really want to do, but oh my God, I need someone to give me the money to do it. I need to raise money to do it. You know, it's.
No, I was just going to ask you, as an executive, as someone who's worked in the business, if you see somebody do everything we were just talking about, that has spent a couple years building out their own IP, building out novels, building out like a little world, like a little mini Disney, maybe a couple t-shirts here, maybe a graphic novel there, and they've been able to do all of this, isn't that much more impressive to you? Like, wouldn't you just want to have a conversation with that person to just figure out, like, how are you doing? Because I've had those meetings. I've had a studio executives call me just like, dude, how are you doing this? Like, I just want to know how you are running your business. And then we'll talk about your projects. I feel it's much more impressive. It shows a lot about the person, and it shows a lot about their work ethic and it says volumes about who they are as an artist and as a business person.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true more than anything, because it is a visibility and view into the kinds of things that they're interested in and the kinds of things they're working on. Like, the really hard thing is, as a screenwriter, it might be comparable if you had meetings with people and they were to ask you questions like, so how many scripts have you written? You know, like how many have you sold? You know, like what, how many paid gigs have you gotten? But they don't ask those questions. So it's hard to contextualize for an executive that you're meeting with, if you're just a screenwriter. It's hard to contextualize whether you are incredibly experienced or this thing you're meeting on is, you know, like a lucky swing right out of the gate, or whether it's, you know, something you kind of got a handle on, but you just kind of lucked into. Like, it's really hard to take a meeting as solely a screenwriter. And again, unless you have a ton of credits to your name that people can look up, say, you know, look, you are in good hands here. Like, my work speaks for itself, you know, because you're otherwise relying on, you know, either word of mouth or your agents to kind of put your name out there and say, well, no, he did a really great uncredited rewrite on this thing, or he did an amazing draft of this movie that's, you know, that the option expired and it's dead. You know, like, it's really hard to contextualize all of the hard work and the good work you put in as a screenwriter. But if you are the kind of person that is, again, entrepreneurial and developing other things, it is so much easier to, again, point to things and say, you know, point to the, hey, I made that thing, and say, hey, look, like, I have this website, I have this, you know, book series, I have this, you know, this wiki page that is all about the crazy, you know, interconnected world that I've written in my sci-fi graphic novel series. So I think that makes it more interesting, because, again, if you're just looking at scripts, the script has to speak for itself, and you have to hope that the guy or gal reading it loves that one script enough to want to meet you, right? Or has heard enough good things about you over the years to be like, I got to meet that person because other people have worked with him and say he's great. But yeah, like I said, you know, if you're doing a bunch of your own things in an entrepreneurial way, you increase the chances that someone will come across it in an unconventional way, like just living their life, link, you know, someone sends you a link or someone says, hey, have you checked this out? It's more likely to get checked out because not a lot of people will, even when you say, you got to read this script, it's amazing, it's hard for people to find time to read 120 right. pages, right. But to watch a 2-minute, you know, YouTube clip, like, sure, like, yeah, I'll put that on. And then once you catch their attention, then when they find you online and find your presence and find the things that you've made, again, see you in that, like, oh my God, he made this and he did this and he tried that and that's interesting. Oh, how'd that turn out? So then even if it's not, you know, I sold 180,000 copies of my sci-fi novel, it's, maybe not, but you have something really interesting going on here that people seem to respond to, and that's worth the conversation most often.
Right. And I loved, you said something, two words that really resonated with me, and I think we should dig into a little bit. It's being just a screenwriter. The concept of being just a screenwriter, I want to dig into a little bit because I agree with you. I think, I'm going to ask you the question. Do you think being just a screenwriter is enough if you're starting out? You know, it's because if you have credits, if you're old school, if you started in the 80s or the 90s or even the early 2000s, you have something under your belt, that's a different conversation. But just starting out now, unless you've got the next, you are the next Pulp Fiction, you know, you're the next Tarantino or Sorkin or Shane Black, unless you're that, which 9.999% out of 10 is not going to be that person. Do you think that a screenwriter should be more than just a screenwriter?
I think it depends on the interest. I don't think that there is anything wrong with being just a screenwriter. I think there are people out there for whom writing screenplays is the only thing they want to do and feel called to do. And that's there should be no shame or stigma attached to that.
Agreed.
But I think it is a harder path now than it used to be.
Right.
Screenwriting jobs are fewer and far between. You know, it is harder and harder to get your name out there as a screenwriter. It's harder and harder to get your name on stuff that actually gets produced and get credits for. So I think that it is harder to be just a screenwriter and not have other irons in the fire. That's not to say that it can't be done, and that's not to say that it shouldn't be done if that's really what you feel like your career is aimed towards. And, you know, most importantly, I think that it's important not to force yourself into a category that you don't. Like, I cannot count the number of writers that assume they need to be writers and directors because that's how they get stuff made, but have no interest in directing. And boy, it shows when they try to make a short film.
Right.
So it's kind of one of those things where I always kind of tell people, like, And it's funny because I just had this conversation with a friend of mine where he was asking, you know, does it make sense to always kind of be writing the same type of project or to like to do a whole bunch of different things? And I think there was a time where being just a screenwriter who only wrote screenplays in one particular genre might have been the way to go because, you know, you're the horror guy, you're the comedy guy, you're the dialogue punch-up guy. But I think more and more, I think that it is more advantageous to be someone who has a wide variety of interests and even more has a wide variety of mediums they're interested in. Because again, I think that in this changing landscape where, I mean, in the last decade, you know, TV has completely overtaken film in terms of like the number of productions that are out there and the type of content that's being out there. And there's nothing to say that, you know, 10 years from now, it won't be something else. Video games, it might be animation. It might like, who knows? Like with COVID, animation might really take off in the next
Year. It's holodeck filmmaking. It's only going to be holograms and we're going to be inside the story. That's the next thing.
There you go. Yeah. So, you know, and the fact that there's so many changing variables, I think that, the more irons you have in the fire, I think the more likely you are to find success. It may be unconventional success that you don't expect. Like, it may be one of those things where – and it's funny because talking about all the self-publishing writing that I'm doing, like, I cannot tell you the number of writers I know that self-publish books and make in excess of $250,000 a year.
Right.
And you have never heard of them.
Exactly.
They're not on bookshelves. They're not at Barnes & Noble. And it's one of those things where I think that it is going to require someone to be able to accept the fact that the reality doesn't match the dream. And we talked about that briefly, where it's like the dream is, you know, I write a screenplay whenever I feel like it. I sell it. I show up for the premiere, get my picture taken, do a bunch of interviews, then go back home and write another screenplay. Like,
that is
already unrealistic and off the mark from what reality is. But
it was unrealistic when it was happening, which is like the 80s and the 90s when the spec boom happened.
It makes me want to shake those people and say, which writer told you that this is the way it was? Because I don't know anyone who this experience is indicative of, you know? But I think it's going to take – so people have already kind of accepted, I think, and moved into – like if you're talking with people who have seriously taken their writing career seriously as a screenwriter and they have realistic expectations, then they now know – you know, it's a slog. There's a lot of disappointment. There's a lot of false starts. Like, they have a more realistic sense of what that job is. But I think it could potentially shift even more in the future, where now it becomes, look, if you are a creative person, if you are a writer who writes stories, then you may be writing things in a variety of different mediums and you never know what may take off. It may be a web series for which you have a Patreon that pays your bills. It may be, an independent book sale where you get 70% royalties at Amazon that pays your bills. It might be screenwriting where you get a huge six-figure paycheck every couple of months. Or, you know, if I had to put my money on it, probably a combination of everything where, you know, in order for me to quit my day job, and by the way, I love day jobs. I don't understand why more writers feel like they can't have them. I'm like, I love the fact that my writing is extra money and not, oh God, can I pay the mortgage, you know, with my writing paycheck before I need to get another one. But for me to get comfortable with leaving my day job and being a full-time creator, that has to come with obviously a certain amount of income to support my family, you know, my bills, my responsibilities. And I don't see that as coming from just screenwriting. You know, I see that coming as, you know, my tax return at the end of the year, most likely in that situation, is going to look like, oh, okay, here's a $50,000 rewrite I did on a screenplay, and here's the $8,000 I made on Amazon from my book sale. Here's the $2,500 from my Patreon account, and you add up all of those sources of revenue to get at a level where you can support your family. And I think that, again, the writers who are like, I only do this one thing and I can only do that, are going to have a harder time because each of those revenue streams is becoming harder and harder to succeed at. So the ones that are open to doing multiple ones and you know, seeing where that revenue comes from are going to be the ones that are able to survive as full-time creators more easily because they're not relying on that real rare circumstance where like, God, I hit it out of the park in that one arena.
So you're suggesting people hustle, sir, is what you're saying. They have to hustle.
At the risk of quoting what's on your hat, yes, I think a hustle might be the appropriate word for it.
Well, I mean, I'll use an analogy of what happened in my career. I started off as an editor, and I was just a commercial editor. I just did commercials in Miami when I first started out. And then when I came to LA, I realized that like, oh, everybody here has a Final Cut machine. Everyone's an editor here. I'm going to go into color grading. So I now can edit. And then I started color grading because it was less competition in color grading. And then when everybody started getting more color grading systems, I'm like, well, you know what? I'm going to go also do post-production supervision because I kind of understand the whole thing. So now I do three jobs in post. And then I'll also do an online editorial. I'll be on the editorial too. So like I could package and master films as well to get it all out there. Oh, and I see I'm doing some VFX. I'll just become a VFX supervisor as well because I could do VFX on the independent films. So now because of that, I was always eating. I was always working because I spread myself out. And I know guys who were like, no, all I do is edit promos. All I do is I'm just a trailer editor or I only do TV. Like they really specialize. And that was a very old mentality to do. And when things started to close down, their reel was only promos and they couldn't get work. They had to start from scratch as opposed to really diversifying their skill set and what services that they can provide to a potential client. And I agree with you 100% that writers now, if you're a writer, you should write. And there's so many, either between side hustles of writing blog posts, writing other things that you can get on a freelance basis through Upwork or Fiverr, things like that, just to write and get paid to write. There's books, there's podcasts, you know, from your books, there's web series. There's so many ways to start generating revenue. And then additional, like you said, oh, and I can maybe do that rewrite for $20,000 or $50,000. And putting it all together at the end of the year, you're like, oh man, I had a pretty good year. As opposed to the old school mentality of like, I just screenwrite and I only got two screening jobs and I made $100,000 this year, which is not a bad thing. But for whatever reason, if those two jobs go away, I'm screwed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's to the point of, you know, again, treating your career like a business. You are the brand. Right. You are the business. And if you were in, you know, in any other field, the idea of only having one stream of income would be insane. If you were in financial services and someone said and a financial advisor was like, you know what you should do? You should pick one stock you really like and put all your money in that. Like, you would not hire that guy again. Right. And the same thing though, like the same thing is true of a place like Disney. If Disney decided at one point, we're not going to do anything else, no theme parks, no merch, no whatever, we're only going to put movies in theaters. Like they would, like their board would revolt, like, you know? So it's kind of one of those things where, again, if you are a serious creative professional and you see yourself as a company or a brand or something, like why would you not also think that diversification is important for you? Why would you think that only screenwriting is the only way forward and the only source of revenue you can have rather than looking for other ways? And, you know, you have a number of other, you know, services, and I've had a bunch of people on this podcast that have other, you know, businesses, and you see that all the time. You know, someone is a writer and a script consultant and they do coverage work.
And they have an online course or something. Yeah.
Or they have an online course or they work a day job. Like that mentality I think is so important. And I have so many writer friends I know that feel like they are a failure as a writer if they can't make ends meet from their screenwriting every year.
That's no.
And they say, you know, gee, I had a good year the year before, but this year I made zero, you know, and it's been a real struggle. And I always kind of be like, why don't you go out and get something else that will help, you know, pay the bills or will help pass the time or, you know, will help make you feel creatively fulfilled. Like there is no reason you have to only stay in one lane when every other, you know, financial advice in every other area of your life is diversify, diversify, diversify so that you can both manage, you know, manage disappointments and also, you know, and mitigate risk. Like you should be doing that in your creative endeavors as well.
Without question. And that was what I did with Post. Like I was a director, but directing jobs were few and far between. And they, you know, like just like getting that screenwriting gig, getting a directing gig, you know, someone's going to give you $200,000-$300,000. It's a lot of, of a budget to do a commercial or do a music video or whatever. I couldn't survive on just doing that. So I always had post-production as my base. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. then, and because I was able to build that business up as a director, I can go, oh, by the way, if you hire me as a director, I'll throw in post or I'll package it all together.
I was just going to say the other benefit is, you know, is additional areas of expertise that then become, you know, value adds to, you know, to what you're doing. And again, you know, maybe it's not as, you know, if it's a super low budget indie, then yeah, maybe it's like I'm the director and also the post supervisor and also the colorist. And
well, yeah. No, but for commercial work, for music video work, for client work, for even series. Like I did a series for Legendary where I did everything, and it was a good budget. But if it wasn't me doing everything, we couldn't have done it because the budget was too low, but it was perfect for me.
Right, but then that experience also translates into if you just want a director job. I mean, if you're going up for, you know, directing a Marvel movie or whatever, like that's a completely different thing.
But
you can also then say, but I've worked in post. I understand what a post supervisor does.
Oh, yeah.
I understand what a VFX person does. So you're not going to have a problem with me not understanding and appreciating the value that other people add. And like – being able to communicate with them and being able to effectively execute those areas become really, really important. And I mean, I kind of have that in my job too, which is, you know, I work in primarily business affairs, and there are an awful lot of people I work with that have only ever worked in business affairs. So they don't understand the larger context beyond like negotiating the agreement and getting the deal done. And as someone who has spent most of his career bouncing around, I've worked in creative, I've worked in physical production, I've worked in operations. At the risk of tooting my own horn, I think one of my strengths as, you know, as an executive is having experience with that whole process so that I can say, I understand why creative is asking us for this thing. I understand the limitations that we need to go back to them with. I understand, you know, from a legal perspective, why we can and can't do that. I understand from working with post why that's like why we can't do this, but maybe we can do this instead. And it's such a valuable skill to be able to say, not just here's the one thing I do and I do it well, but here's the thing I do and I do it well. And I do it well because I understand all of the different moving pieces I have to interact with and can help explain and work with those areas. Because it's just, again, this is such a collaborative business. Even if you're a one-man show, you know, doing your own thing, like you still have to work with other people. And the more you can understand where they're coming from and what their needs are, like the better partner you're going to be with them. And those are the people that get hired over and over again is that guy gets me. He understands that I have budget constraints to care about. And it's not just about, you know, how good the script is. You know, that post guy gets me because he knows I need to stay on budget no matter what, but I don't have a lot of money and I need to make the most of what I have. You know, like those are the kinds of things, the people that get hired so often because they give people value.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you when I was working with directors who were just directors and they had no idea about the post-production process, it used to drive me mad. It would be just so upsetting because it'd be like, well, we're going to do this and this. Well, I don't know how to do anything of that. And I'm like, dude, this is like your business, man. Like, this is what you do. Why don't you – you don't have to be an expert in what I do, but you should have a conversation, like basic conversation. Read a book, man.
the funniest story I had in film school was, so my film school had two different tracks. There was the production track and then there was the studies track, right? And
so one makes money and one track makes money, the other track doesn't make money.
Well, exactly. So what ended up being funny is the production track was all for the, you know, aspiring directors, the they wanted to make their own films. And the studies track was where I ended up going because there were so many more interesting classes. There was a production management class. That's where the writing classes were. Like there were so many different areas that I was interested in. And it was so funny because by the time film school ended, I was the go-to producer on all my friends' shows because they were all on the production track, but none of them knew how to like actually make the thing. They just knew how to like – most of them – knew how to boss actors around and they knew, you know, some of them kind of paid attention in cinematography class. So kind of got a sense of like angles and light and lenses and stuff like that. But beyond that, they couldn't tell you, you know, how to do a schedule or a budget or where to show up or the logistics of having, you know, a company move. So it's funny how, you know, like you said, people who want to be just directors or, you know, whatever, and have no interest in learning the other areas, like that's where the real value is even if you haven't spent a decade doing that job, a director that knows what each person that works for them does and what their capacity and requirements are is such a valuable addition because they're the guy that can be like, yeah, okay, I get it. Like, you're stressed out, you're over budget, you know, what do you need me to do? Or, gee, like, the schedule's, you know, we're running behind today. What do I need to do to catch up? And that's the stuff, again, that, you know, that makes you a working professional rather than, you know, someone who occasionally gets work and, you know, like, I cannot count the number of directors that I've worked with that, you know, especially on big studio movies, that get sidelined when they can't deliver on time. And it's just like, okay, great. Like, you had fun doing your creative stuff. We're going to go finish the day now because we have 8 more pages to shoot. You know, it's just.
Right. And that's the other thing, going back to the screenwriting aspect of it. I think a screenwriter who understands production, or at least understands, like we were saying earlier, understands costs and what things do cost and time and things like that, when they're doing a rewrite, when they're you know, hired to do a polish, and if they, like you said, if they can shave dollars off and still able to tell that story, you will work constantly, because it's all about, for the studio or whoever's putting out the money, it's about ROI, return on investment. If you can return more money to them, then you will always work. And that's why, you know, writer directors like Robert Rodriguez has worked constantly throughout his career, because he's able to produce high quality products. You like him, don't like him, irrelevant. Tyler Perry, a lot of people don't like his stuff. He's laughing all the way to the bank. I think I just read somewhere that he shot 42 episodes of his show in like 4 or 5 days.
Like 4 days? Like, crazy.
Like, I'm just curious. I would love to just be a fly on the wall to see how he's doing. I'm assuming it's very play-like, where it's just like, boom, 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 and they just cover the hell out of it and we're out the door. But his audience is good. And look at a writer. Look, that's a perfect example of what we're talking about. Look at a writer who wanted to be a screenwriter, who wanted to make movies, but he couldn't break in. So what did he do? He started writing plays. And when then he started producing his own plays. Then he would go on tour with his own plays, and he built something up for himself, and built up this community, and built up this world, this ecosystem, if you will, of all the stuff that he was doing with Madea and all that stuff, to the point where he finally got a shot with Diary of an Angry Black Woman, which then exploded, and then he leveraged that, and then over the course of the last 20 years, he's literally built this empire where now he is the only filmmaker I know, and I don't even think Lucas had this. Lucas had other toys, but he built an entire studio for himself.
Yeah, it's so funny. So, like, I worked with a producer this one time, and again, most people probably wouldn't know his name, but like, he had a very similar to like kind of like the way Jason Blum did with Blumhouse, where like he had a formula for the way he made stuff, and he had made a lot of money making movies over the years, to the point where he had bought himself basically, you know, a lot, you know, where he could shoot, and he had a back lot built and everything. And it was funny working with him, because so many of the notes were, you know, I don't have an airport set, but I do have a coffee shop, a restaurant, a, you know, whatever. So make it fit in one of those.
Very Corman-esque.
Exactly. But, you know, it was one of those things where, again, like, you may look down on the fact that he makes, you know, kind of cheesy movies that are all kind of the same, but like, his model was, I don't spend a dollar over $1 million to make it, because I sell it to the cable networks for 1.5. And I do that 8 times a year. Like, I don't, like, there's nothing stupid about that business model where you're making 500 grand 8 times over every year, like clockwork, you know, and you have your model, you know what you're building, you know what you're shooting. Like, it's just, it's funny how often people try to like divest creativity from business and see them as negatives or opposite sides of a coin, where it's like, oh, if you do something that's smart business, it can't possibly be creative. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Doing 8 movies a year with the same sets and making them all seem different is about the most creative thing I can think of to do, much more than like, I have an original set that I built for, you know, this one movie, and then I tear it all down at the end.
And again, if you're Spielberg or Nolan or, you know, or these giants, that's great, but that's the exception to the rule, and not everybody is ever going to be Spielberg, and no one's, you know, or Cameron or Scorsese or any of these giants. You got to walk your own path and build your own world. I think we are now in the age of the entrepreneurial screenwriter, the entrepreneurial filmmaker, or the filmtrepreneur, as I call it, because that is the way forward. I think a lot of people are still writing, and making films or trying to make films like it's 1997. And that world is gone. Literally gone with COVID.
Yeah, it is so much harder to work within the system when there is so much stuff out there. And again, it's about attention. It's about getting someone who, again, is in a position to pay you to do something. It's about getting their attention and getting their interest. And again, there are some executives I know that are old school, I read scripts and that's all I do every day. And then I find a good script and I meet the writer and that's it. But I mean, like I said, there are so many more executives I know now that have diverse interests, and they're constantly watching web series and surfing YouTube and looking for, TikTok or whatever, whatever the new thing is, trying to find interesting, interesting voices so that they can come in and talk to them. And I do really wonder I would be curious, and again, I don't work in development, so I don't have any hard and fast numbers on this, but I would genuinely be interested in, if you look at the total number of meetings an executive takes these days, a creative exec, how many of them are, I am a screenwriter, I write screenplays, you read my screenplay, liked it, and now you want to meet with me, versus like, hey, you're an interesting content creator that I found somewhere else. I really want to see, see what you can, I just want to have a conversation with you and talk and see if there's anything there.
Right. And I think the second conversation is much more interesting for me, at least, than the first one. I think we could leave it at this. If you're able to express yourself creatively as a writer and make money doing all these other things that we're talking about, whether it's writing novels, self-publishing, web series, graphic novels, podcasts of your stories, whatever those other avenues are, if you're able to build a small business around your art, whatever that is, and that art could bring in $50,000 to $70,000 a year or whatever the number is for you to be able to provide for you and your family, whatever that, because depending on where you live in the world, that number can vary. Whatever that, if you can do that and keep doing that for years, year after year, why are you so concerned about making it big somewhere else? You're living the dream at that point. And then if someone shows up, great. But you're happy in this process as opposed to being someone, I mean, I don't know about you. How many writers are just angry, bitter, unhappy because it hasn't worked out the way they wanted to, because they've been sold a raw deal or this illusion that we've been talking about where you write the spec script, get $1 million and just go off and, into your Hawaiian palace somewhere and surf all day and then write when you want. That's not a really practical thing. And I think they've been sold a raw deal. I think they've sold a myth. And they're pissed about it. Where I think is, if you're able to build out a business around your art, whatever that is, then you're happy. And that took me a long time to figure out, because I was the angry and bitter filmmaker for most of my career. And I always say, if you don't know an angry and bitter filmmaker, if you don't know an angry and bitter screenwriter, you are the angry and bitter screenwriter.
No, it's true. I think to leave it, I think that the constant evolution of your expectations is something that's really important, and I was the same way. When I graduated from film school, again, you have the sights on, I'm a screenwriter writing, writing Marvel movies, seeing my name on screen and stuff like that.
Sure.
And what's funny is over the years, I hit that disappointment that everyone does where it's like, okay, that my life didn't work out the way that I just, assumed it would at 22. But then you start thinking about really kind of the things that are important, right? You start getting your bucket list of, experiences together. And it's funny because, now that I've worked at Marvel, one of the nice perks is that they credit all of their in-house people on their films, right? So, it's one of those things where it's like, I have gotten a credit on a Marvel movie. Does it say credits executive, halfway down the crawl rather than, written by? Sure. Is that really that important to me that the writing credit is the only thing that'll make me happy? No, not so much. I've always loved studio lots and I've worked on one now. So, that bucket list is done. I've been paid for my writing, not a lot, but I've gotten a check that says, for your writing services. And it's just been important to reevaluate once you do have that, that hard crushing reality check of things not working out how you want, and finding out what really is important to you. and deciding, you know, what makes you happy. And for me, it's one of those things where, like, I really enjoy my day job at Marvel. I like the people I work with. I love those movies. So the chance to work on them, even if it's, you know, vetting the names in the end crawl, which is like not terribly exciting, but like, it's something that I find immensely satisfying and I enjoy. It's something that I wouldn't mind doing as a day job until the day I retire. And then on top of that, I'm able to supplement it with creative projects that interest me. I can make a short film when I want. I can write a script. I can write a book. And most importantly to me, I don't ever have to worry about that thing being a financial success because I have a day job that pays my bills for me. So everything else is just on top of that. Mm-hmm. And what's been really nice about that is, to me, that is my definition of a successful life. It's my successful career where I have found a way to be happy and content with the things I have achieved and able to set more realistic goals than just being like, oh my God, if I don't have a written by credit on a Marvel movie before I retire, like my whole life's meant nothing up to this point, you know? And it's hard because that, in comparison to a lot of writers I know that are full-time writers and won't allow themselves to do anything else, like full-time screenwriters that won't take a day job or whatever. And I just see so much struggle and so much frustration with, you know, the living paycheck to paycheck or the feast or famine nature of the business. And it's just, I always think it's important to really reevaluate those things that are important to you. And for me, writing is important, but it's not so important that I can't also, you know, pay the bills of the day job or find other ways of feeling like I've met certain thresholds for success that I have for myself. And I think these days that's what a lot of writers and other creatives are faced with, which is you need to figure out your definition of success, and it's probably not going to be what you originally thought it was. You're probably not going to make your money from where you thought you were. You're probably not going to make the fame and fortune from where you thought you were. It's probably going to come in a different form. Are you okay with that or not?
And I don't know about you, but when I didn't get to the Oscars at 25,
you and me both. I was sitting at home being like, man, I should have had it.
And then I'm like, well, I'll wait till 30. And then you push to 35. And then you always have that conversation. You're like, oh man, but Spielberg made Jaws when he was 27. You know, Orson Welles made, you know, Citizen Kane when he was 23. You know, Tarantino was what, 31 when he made, or 30 when he made Reservoir. You know, and every year that those lines just keep going back and back till you finally just go, you know what? I'm just not those guys. I got to walk my own path. And when you become comfortable with that, life becomes a lot more pleasant in this business. And I think that's where a lot of the pain comes from, when you're just holding on to these ideas that you've been taught or you've heard of growing up in this business. And when they don't come to fruition, which, by the way, 99.9% of people don't get their dream exactly the way they want it. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, like I can't remember if you saw it on Twitter. It was about a month ago now, but there was a survey going around about how old the world they got their first like directing, producing, you know, like writing gig. And like it's so funny because like the stereotype or the assumption is that, you know, everyone that makes it in Hollywood is, you know, some, you know, 23-year-old fresh out of college, you know, success story. And the reality is, I think they said that of all of the like the Oscar-winning directors of the last 10 years, like the average age is like 41 where they directed their first film, you know? And it's just, it's like, it is, and maybe it's reassuring because I'm, you know, approaching 40, you know, in a little over a year. So, you know, maybe that's reassuring to me, but you know, but whether it's that or whether it's authors saying I didn't write my first book until I was 44 or 50, like there is no, you're not out of time. You're not out
There's
of time
never,
until you
never.
Stop crying. Like you Agreed. Can break in anytime. It could be your next project. It could be your 10th project from now. Like there is no hard and fast rule. As long as you're willing to still go for it and still, again, to quote your hat, hustle, you know, like you can break in with anything at any time, you know, and that's what motivates me to keep going is, you know, the idea that an opportunity could be just around the corner that could pay off.
Absolutely. Listen, I made my first feature at 41, so it took me 20 years to break through the mental block of making a feature film, and I just went out and did it. So, and I was, that's my path. And by the way, the first thing you do is not going to be Reservoir Dogs. It's not going to be Paranormal Activity. It's not going to be Iron Man. It's not going to be this monster cultural hit that you dream about. It could be. And if that's you, please call me. You can come on the show. But but generally speaking, for the rest of us, it's not that. And you just have to be okay with that and keep going forward on your own path. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. Because you're not going to be Orson Welles. You're not going to be Tarantino. You're not going to be Sorkin. You're not going to be Black or Joe Esterhaus. That's not the world that we live in. You know, look at Jordan. Look at Jordan Peele. He was on Comedy Central doing skit comedy for years, and all of a sudden he became this generation's Hitchcock. Like, literally overnight. Like, coming from comedy, and he just like, I'm going to write like one of the better horror screenplays ever written. I'm going to do that now, and I'm going to also direct it. Like, do you see? I just want people listening. I promise you, Jordan Peele did not sit down and go, you know what? I'm going to do about a decade of comedy on a cable network, and I'm going to do really well on that. But then I'm going to shift gears, and I'm going to do horror, and I'm going to rebrand my entire self as a horror guy because that's what I really love. I guarantee you that wasn't a conversation. It just kind of happened. Now I'm going to ask you a couple questions to ask all my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
I think it's probably applies to both the film business and life, but it's basically kind of what we were talking about. Don't wait for someone to give you permission to do something. And the corollary to that, which is like, no one is going to advocate for you better than yourself. I spent a lot of years waiting for people to like recognize my hard work and waiting to reward me for
your genius.
For my genius. exactly. And it's funny because I learned that from my parents, who both came from this world where you work at a job and you just do a good job and the company takes care of you until you retire. And that is most definitely not been my experience in the professional world lately. I spent a lot of time just saying, well, look, if I just do a really good job and I come and I show up to work every day, eventually, like, you know, I will get all the things that I want. And it took me a long time to realize how often that's just not true. People go, oh, thanks for doing the work. Appreciate it. Have a good day. And I've had to fight for everything that I've wanted by hard work, you know, dedication, you know, persistence. And it took me a long time to realize that, you know, I was waiting around for someone to give me permission or recognize that I was able to do more than I was doing. And now that I've kind of learned that lesson, it's a lot easier for me to advocate for myself and go out there and do the things I really want to do, because, you know, I know that the inspiration and the enthusiasm is going to start with me.
Now, what are three screenplays that every screenwriter should read?
I think the three scripts that I think affected me the most and are great examples of, you know, people writing that great script that really got them noticed was Passengers by John Spates is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. That was really good one, yeah.
Story of Your Life by Eric Heiser, which became Arrival, which he got nominated for an Oscar for, blew my mind. And then my friend Bob Sines wrote a script called Orphans that got made into an indie movie called Extracurricular Activities last year. And he has had that script as his calling card script for 20 years. And he still gives it to me. And they still email him and say, oh my God, that's one of the best scripts I've read. The twist at the end just blew my mind. And it finally got made. They spent 20 years. It got optioned, I think, 8 or 9 different times. Like, wow. It just never, like, it was a true, like, if you ever want to, you should have him on the podcast at some point.
Please.
To talk about
please.
That process.
Yes.
Because he is like the quintessential, like, 20-year overnight success story where everyone's like, oh my God, you got your movie made. That's great. And he's like, yeah, 20 years after I optioned it the first time.
Absolutely. Bob is going to be on the show. If Bob wants to be on the show, I want to have Bob on the show. And now, where can people find you and the work that you're doing?
Most of the stuff I do these days, I'm on Twitter most often. I'm at jwillis81. I also have a somewhat defunct blog, All Rights Reserved, WRITES, which is where I kind of post articles on the business of writing whenever I can think of that. And then ultimately, I'm working on a business of writing book that hopefully will help some people out. Hoping to have it published by the end of the year. But follow me on Twitter. That's where I make most of my announcements and make most of my rants on the business end of things.
I need to talk to you about your marketing, because when you say the defunct blog, it's just generally not very appetizing.
I feel like I couldn't in good conscience say it was active when I think the last post was like from February of this year. So.
Well, that's fair. There's been a lot of people who stopped posting in February because of obvious reasons. It's just like the world is upside down.
It wasn't for lack of wanting to update this, the website. Let me just say that.
Jeff, man, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate your take on the business. And hopefully some screenwriters listening right now will start thinking about taking their career in a different path that can make them happier and more successful. So I do appreciate your input, man. Thank you so much, my friend.
It was a pleasure to be on the show. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to thank Jeff for coming on the show and inspiring the tribe to think a little bit differently about how you can make money with your screenplays. I plan to be doing some more stuff in regards to the entrepreneurial screenwriter in the coming months, so keep an eye out for that. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/088. And guys, if you need some help with developing your story, I have a new course at IFH Academy called The Foundations of Screenwriting Story Development, taught by Jeffrey Calhoun, who is the writer of the best-selling book, The Guide for Every Screenwriter. So just head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/story-course. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.